Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloam. Our guest is Jim Hartz. Born and raised in Oklahoma, Hartz was plucked at age 24 from Tulsa to become the youngest correspondent ever hired by NBC. One night, while recording an update on one of the Gemini missions in 1966, he found out that the mission was in serious trouble as Commander Neil Armstrong struggled to regain control of their spacecraft that was spinning wildly out of control. Hart stayed on the air for hours for live coverage that helped lead to a career that covered the rest of the Gemini program and all of the Apollo missions, including the 6 moon landings and the Apollo-Soyuz test project with the Russians in 1975. Coincidentally, that was the last time American astronauts splashed down after returning from space, until Doug Hurley and Bob Behnken splashed down off Pensacola, Florida, recently in their SpaceX Dragon Demo 2 spacecraft. Hartz worked with and knew some of the giants of television news in the 1960s and 70s, including Chet Huntley, David Brinkley, and his personal mentor and fellow Oklahoman, Frank McGee. When McGee passed away in 1971, Hartz took over co-hosting the Today Show with Barbara Walters. In that role, he interviewed a 9-year-old Tracy Cernan while her father Gene was walking on the moon during the last crewed lunar exploration, Apollo 17. A story we'll hear about in detail later. Jim Hartz joined us from his home in Alexandria, Virginia. Jim Hartz, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much. You're in one of my favorite parts of the country, Northern California. I spent some time in San Francisco working out there at the PBS station.
Yeah, and we're a bit north of there. Well, let's get started talking to you about your career. One of the things that you mentioned to me when we spoke the other day was about your love of flight. And I think that kind of weaves through your whole career and the things that we're interested in talking about in your coverage of the space program. How did you first get interested in flying?
Well, the first time I was ever in an airplane, this light plane, I was probably about 10 years old. And growing up, I grew up out in Oklahoma. And so it's pretty flat land, you know, and I didn't know there was a world much beyond a few blocks away, you know, as far as you could see. And once I got up in the air, the new world, the real world exploded in my eyes. And I thought, you know, this is really something that I'd never dreamed of. And I think from that time on, I loved flying and actually wanted to fly. My brother, older brother, was an Air Force pilot, and later on, not when I was 10, but later on when I was about 20 or so, he taught me how to fly. And also he had a light plane, and we flew a lot out there when I would, especially after I lived in New York and so on, and go home, and we'd fly right down on the deck, chase an antelope, the Air Force pilots called them. So I got to really enjoy it and so on. But after moving to New York and Washington, I thought that's no place for an amateur to be flying. And so I let it go, except I got to fly a lot of stuff as a reporter. Some pretty heavy duty stuff, as a matter of fact. I got to fly with the Blue Angels. I was the first reporter to fly a U-2 spy plane. By the way, I guess I was in your neck of the woods out there. We flew it out of
Beale,
yeah. And then later on, I flew the SR-71 also out of Beale.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
SR was, we went to 80,000 feet, flew at Mach 3.15 is what they advertise it. And it seemed to me like there was oomph left in it when we leveled off. So I don't know what that final speed and altitude was.
You almost qualify for your astronaut wings for that.
Well, yeah, that's true. As a matter of fact, we had a program, you know, that was designed to put a journalist in space. In fact, it was called the Journalist in Space Program. And I applied for it and was among the semifinalists, but it was canceled after the Challenger. And if you recall, there was a school teacher on board.
Krista McAuliffe,
and she was the last civilian to fly. They no longer were going to take up people who weren't astronauts or scientists, astronauts. Well, they did take up a couple of senators. Took up John Glenn and I think one other senator, I can't remember who, but but anybody who was a reporter or school teacher or whatever, that was the end of that program, those programs.
Yeah, that was a shame. Let's move forward a little bit to your education, because I find this an interesting part of your career, is you studied to become a doctor. You were a pre-med major. And tell me about that experience, and then, you know, later on, how that benefited you.
Yeah, I came from a family with four boys, and everybody's supposed to have their own future and occupation and so on. And I had a lot of pressure from one of my brothers. In fact, it was the guy that taught me how to fly, that to be a doctor. We needed a doctor in the family, was what he kept saying. And so I thought, well, that's not a bad idea. So I was in, went through 3 years of pre-med, and spent a lot of time, and pre-med in those days was kind of a lot different than it is now. We had a heavy emphasis on physics and chemistry and cell biology and, the heavy duty science curriculum. And at the end of my junior year, I decided that's not what I wanted to do. So I had a minor in speech and English, and so I switched over to that. But later on, and what you're talking about was, I thought for quite a while after that, that my college education had been wasted. And because the journalism was my first love at that point, and I'd gone to work as a correspondent at NBC in New York, when the Apollo program was just in the planning stages, Gemini was underway, but it was so new. It's hard for anybody that wasn't alive at the time to realize this was a really big deal in America and all over the world. And America, and especially, was having putting men into space was really something. And when Kennedy said we're going to send a man to the moon, that really excited the country and so on. So when men would go up in space flights in Gemini's, where I started, we would do on the air, on the network, about once an hour, a little 1 minute bulletin. And it would say, the astronauts are flying over the Pacific and or the Atlantic, or they're somewhere, or they're sleeping, or they're having dinner, or something like that. Just, up to date. And at that time, I was anchoring the 11 o'clock news in New York, where those bulletins were being done. And I would, every hour, go up to the studio and read one of these prepared bulletins, and that was it. But I also sort of got in the background in the program because I figured that I better know something about what I was talking about. So I'd read a couple of the books on the Gemini program. And so it wasn't completely out of my water at that point. So on the night in 19, Dave, you got to help me out here because my memory is.
I believe it was 67.
Gemini 8, was it?
Gemini 8 with Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott.
That's right, right. They were to rendezvous and dock with another set spacecraft that had been sent up earlier, and they did that successfully in their Gemini spacecraft. And very shortly, they began to roll in one of the thrusters got stuck open, and so it's thrusting and it's looking like if they don't do something about it, it might tear things apart. They detached from the other spacecraft they were hooked up to, which was an Agena, part of a booster rocket. Then they really started whirling. They were turning at the rate of about almost once a second, 270 degrees a second. That's really whirling around. And Neil got it under control, which everybody always said it was a superb piece of flying. But what he did was he had to use a secondary control system, and the rule said if you open that one, that secondary, you've got to come home right away, first opportunity. So I'm sitting up there reading off this bulletin, and as I finished, the producer came on in my ear and he said, "Don't go away, we got a problem. I'll be back to you in a second. So I'm sitting there all by myself in this huge cavernous 8H studio in New York, wondering what the heck's going on. This is where they do Saturday Night Live, by the way, if you ever watch the show. It's a big place. And pretty soon they come back and say, Jiminy's coming home right away. It's an emergency. And you're going to stay there until we get Chet Huntley and David Brinkley in. Then we'll relieve you and you go back to your office, okay? So I stayed there for a while and I started doing a few little things. They were giving me scripts. I didn't have to know very much and whatever. And then all of a sudden, Brinkley comes in, sits down, and you got Frank McGee back, and producer tells me, we can't find Chet Huntley. And so I, make a long story short, I sat there for about 5 hours because they never found Chet that night. And that was my baptism of fire covering the space program. And from that, they asked me to come aboard. They were expanding and asked me to come aboard as a correspondent to cover Apollo.
Yeah, and you covered pretty much every space flight since then, right? And you covered every space flight.
I covered the rest of the Gemini. I covered all of the Apollos and up to Apollo Soyuz, the joint venture that we had with the Soviets, and the first shuttle. I've seen several other shuttle flights, but that's the last one I covered.
Yeah, John Young and Bob Crippen in Columbia. Can we back up a minute? I'm interested in, you were working, I would assume, in Tulsa at an affiliate for NBC, right? When you started out?
Actually, I was working for a CBS affiliate.
CBS, okay. How did they discover you? Because that's an interesting process that, you know, how you get discovered from one of these affiliates back then and then go to New York. How did they, because you were really young, right?
Yeah, I was 24. I was, at that point, the youngest correspondent they ever hired. What happened was there had been two strikes of the New York newspapers. And during 1964, which is when this was, the strike had gone on, I don't know, for a long time, 2 or 3 months, I believe. And they were looking to expand the newscasts in New York to start with, to make up for the newspapers. And so they sent a guy around to look at people all over the country. They wanted right away people who had experience. And this guy, I talked to him a long time later, found out what happened. He started out around, he went to Cleveland, Detroit, St. Louis, Chicago. He ended up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he would go rent 3 television sets, because in those days you only had 3 networks, and park himself in a motel and start watching newscasts and taking Polaroid pictures of people. Didn't have a recorder. And I was one of those people. And when he got back to New York, he had several recommendations, and I was one of them. And they called me, and we had a discussion on the phone, and they asked me if I'd fly to New York and talk to him. I did. And they hired me. And I was there within less than a month.
It's almost like a baseball scout out there scouring the country for talent.
Yeah, it was. It was. That's a good analogy.
If you're just joining us, our guest is legendary NBC correspondent and anchor Jim Hartz. Hartz covered every U.S. spaceflight from Gemini missions in 1966 and the Apollo program from 1967 to 1975 to the first flight of the space shuttle Columbia in 1980. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with retired NBC TV journalist Jim Hartz. He was one of the principal reporters at the height of the American space program during the late 1960s and early 70s. The space program, from Mercury and Gemini especially, you know, peaking with Apollo in 1969 with the moon landing, that was really a big deal, and the networks covered it wall to wall from, you know, pre-liftoff in the early hours of the morning before liftoff to splashdown. It was on air a lot, and a lot of resources devoted to that. Could you talk about that, just the machinery at NBC, as the one you were involved in covering the space program at the height of it?
Yeah, I think we understood from the beginning that there was going to be a lot of times that we were on the air in which we wouldn't have a picture. And so they started out, I'm going to talk about Apollo now because that's one I know the most about. They started out and had two absolutely scale, they were real models of this spacecraft that landed on the moon, the LEM. The Lunar Excursion Model, LEM as it was called, and the Command and Service Module, which is the one where all three were aboard. And those were inside Studio 8H in there, and they were my bailiwick. They had all the complete controls in them, every switch and every dial and so on, and I knew all of that. I'm not saying that I could have been an astronaut, but I've known where the switches were.
Well, and didn't you do some simulations?
Well, they sent me around both in California and then out on Long Island where the spacecraft were built. And I got to fly the simulators, yeah. It's the hardest one to fly was the actual landing on the moon. I had to crash the simulator into the moon several times before I don't think I ever got it right.
Yeah, that's why I guess we're happy that Neil Armstrong was the first guy that really did that. And as much as I admire you, not Jim Hartz.
Let me just say one thing that most people don't realize, I don't think, was the Apollo spacecraft was controlled almost exclusively by computers.
Yes.
The only time that Neil Armstrong flew that spacecraft was in the last probably 50 or 75 feet before they landed on the moon. And then when they docked, everything else was done by computer with computers that's memory was 64K.
Wow.
Yeah, wow indeed.
About the same as my key fob for my Subaru.
That's about right, yeah. Now, they had the largest computer system in the world on the ground at Houston at that time. IBM, you couldn't believe the size of the computer back room there at NASA. And they would, of course, upload to the spacecraft everything that they needed. I mean, they're tracking it by radar from the Earth, which I think is another fascinating story. They were automated to such a degree that it turned out that for certain aspects of the flight, the computer could fly it better than any pilot. Now, the last part of it, if you recall, the computer was bringing Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin down into what turned out to be a boulder field. And that's when Neil took over. You just flip a button and you're flying it like a helicopter, basically. And he flew over the boulder field and then found a smooth spot and put it down. The same thing, I think, happened on Apollo 12. Conrad told me later, I believe the computer was going to take him into the side of a large crater. So he'd be tipped over, so to speak. Not they're going to turn over, but it was a shallow crater. And he took it and set it on the side of the crater and on a flat place. And at launch, everything is computer controlled on launch. I mean, it's unbelievable what the size of the systems and the speed with which you need to operate them in terms of fuel savings and so on. It's and only the computer can do.
Yeah.
Nothing to take away from the astronauts.
No,
the heroes in my book.
Yeah, well, especially, you know, we don't have time to get into it, but, you know, when you look at, like, what Jim Lovell did flying the LEM with his command service module attached, you know, that was some amazing flying. But let's get back to your role as a journalist and that massive team of people, you know, to give us an idea of the resources that you guys had. So you had the two mock-ups there in the studio. You also did animations, as I recall, you know, because you couldn't see, you know, once they got out of sight from launch, there would be animations where you would see what it would, you know, supposedly look like for the astronauts flying and things like that. Give us a sense of, you know, how much time and preparation would go into preparing for a mission like one of the Apollo missions for your team of journalists at NBC?
At any one time during the Apollo program, which is several years, there was probably about a dozen people, writers and producers, assigned to it permanently. Then those of us like McGee and me and Huntley Merkley and Jack Chancellor and so on, we would come in at the end of the, just before the broadcast and so on. Then the producers, McGee, me, and Chancellor, and everybody, Roy and Neil, would all gather in Houston for about, sometimes 2-3 days, maybe more, of intense briefings from the flight engineers and do interviews with the astronauts for an upcoming flight. This is done for every flight. And we had briefing books on every flight that were like 2 inches thick of, you know, 3-ring notebooks. And on the air, as I said, we were there in 8H, probably 4 or 5 cameras, technicians to operate them, sound and lighting and all that sort of stuff. I would say there's 30 to 50 people involved in New York and then not that many in Houston, but down board the aircraft carrier for splashdown and down at Kennedy Space Center for launch. So at any one time, total for any flight, probably 100 people are involved, engineers and reporters and, you know, writers, producers, and so on. It really was it was one of the biggest things that I think we ever did. Being assigned to it was really interesting because as a reporter, we got to really dig into the story and spend a lot of time with the people who were the sources, the astronauts, the engineers. I made friends at NASA that I still kept for years and years and years. 4 or 5 especially, of which only one is still alive. It's amazing.
Yeah, and briefly tell us, like, who are some of the people that you became particularly close to?
Well, probably the best known was Alan Shepard. He and I stayed in touch over the years, long time after he left the space program. You know, he was the first American in orbit, and then he flew Apollo 14 to the moon. Then the second was Pete Conrad, who was the commander of Apollo 12, which was the second flight to the moon. Pete's co-pilot, a guy named Alan Bean. Well, Pete was probably my closest friend for a long time around NASA. He was unfortunately lost his life in a terrible motorcycle accident 10, 15 years ago. But and Alan died not long ago too. And there was a guy named Floyd Bennett, no relation to the guy that the airfield is named after in Brooklyn. Floyd was in the mission planning and analysis division. And these were the people that wrote all of the computer programs for the launch and the landing and all that sort of stuff. And he used to be one of our briefers, and I got to know him and found out that he was the guy in his unit. If there was any changes that we were going to have to deal with, he would know about it, because they had to know about where the center of gravity was on all the spacecraft. So if you moved a coffee cup from one side to the other of the spacecraft, Floyd knew about it and would keep you briefed. A lot of times, these guys that trusted you and you trusted them would keep you from making mistakes rather than leaking stories to you, so to speak. Then the last of the group that I had known for a long time is a guy named Gerald D. Griffin. Jerry was a flight director in Apollo and then went on to do several other jobs in NASA. He became their congressional liaison here up in Washington. I live across the river from Washington. He retired as system administrator at the Johnson Spacecraft Center in Houston. So I still talk to him, I don't know, several times a year. We're very close.
And those are some amazing people, Jerry Griffin being my personal favorite of the bunch. One of the things that really impresses me, especially, you know, watching the coverage today and comparing it to what I saw, you know, during the Apollo era as a kid, it was, you know, people like you had to go on air and be on for extended periods of time and not just be reading a script, but be able to talk fluently and explain exactly what was going on during these missions and take the technical jargon and the acronyms, which NASA is so famous for, like, for example, TLI, and explain what does that mean for the viewer, and take that NASA speak and some of the physics of the orbital mechanics and things like that and explain it for the viewer to bring them into the mission and have them understand, you know, the hazards involved and what's going on. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, what that was like to be able to just be able to talk about space flight in that way for extended periods of time?
Right. Well, what you do is open those 2-inch thick notebooks and start reading. And I always thought it was a little bit like studying up for the orals of a PhD program. You just had to know what you were talking about, or you were in trouble. TLI, which you mentioned, was called Translunar Injection. I can remember that. That was a big one, because they would initially launch the Apollo spacecraft in an orbit around the Earth and check everything out before they headed for the moon. And the TLI was the burn that they used from the upper stage booster that sent them off onto the moon. So all of that stuff you needed to know, or at least have it where you could find it in a hurry. But I always thought my part of my job, at least, was a little bit like those translators that you hear at the United Nations, who can listen to a speaker and translate it from English into French or French into German or whatever. We were translating NASA speak into English. And that really got to be one of the biggest jobs that they gave to me, was to know what all that stuff was, or at least a good part of it.
Let's talk about one of the really interesting stories, and I knew about this before, but in talking to you about it, it dawned on me how difficult this must have been for you. It was the last flight to the moon, Apollo 17, and you're hosting the Today Show. Back then, the Today Show was you and Barbara Walters and Joe Garagiola, as I recall. And you're covering the mission, and Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt are on one of their EVAs walking on the moon, and you get tasked with interviewing Tracy Cernan, who was just a little girl, 8, 9 years old, something like that. And you had to interview her while her dad was walking on the moon. And you expressed to me that, you know, that gave you great pause.
It did. Dave, I actually was against it. We discussed that, I don't know, 2 or 3 days before it happened. And I thought, you know, this could really be an embarrassment for us and her and her parents and so on, if if we're sitting there live on television, no delay, and something happens to her dad on the moon. I mean, something weird like the spacesuit blowing up, you know, or any kind of anything wrong that would either cause him injury or death, for God forbid, then I'm sitting there with this little girl who has, you know, has no idea what's going on and certainly needs the comfort of somebody besides me. And I thought, you know, that's just not something that I think we ought to be doing. But the more we talked about it, and I think we talked to Gene and his wife and so on, and they were all for it. And I got around to saying, well, yeah, maybe it's a pretty good idea. And it turns out it was. And she was very articulate, and it was just one of the nicest things that I think we ever did. And Gene became a good friend of mine, too, after that. He used to tell people he carried a picture of Jim Hartz around in his wallet, but it was really a picture of Jim Hartz and Tracy, his daughter, watching him on the moon. And so it was... It's one of those things that was fraught with danger, but turned out to be really nice.
Yeah, it really was. And Tracy, I don't remember her exact words, but she was really wonderful in that interview with you. I remember she had a dress with the Apollo 17 mission patch on it, and she just looked absolutely adorable. And she's just a wonderful person.
She was, yeah.
But I remember there was some kind of question about going to the moon to perhaps discover, you know, water there. And Tracy said something like, well, if that's what they're going there for, they're going to the wrong place. Because, you know, she's like, she knew that there's probably no water on the moon. So she was excellent.
There was also something about green cheese or green rocks or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, and she said something about her dad said he would bring her back a moonbeam. And as I recall, yeah, you said right. Either he's pulling your leg or you're pulling mine. That was a really great interview. I enjoyed that. But I'd never thought about it from your standpoint that could be a trauma, you know, if something happens to Gene on the moon with her, you know, and you're there with his daughter on air. I've never thought about it quite that way.
It's, you know, it's one of the hardest things to do in our business because it happens so fast and oftentimes right in front of you unannounced. Is to be able to think ahead, you know, okay, if this doesn't work, what am I going to do? And I'll give you a good example of that, where really thinking ahead was important. On Apollo 12, the second trip to the moon, the moonwalks happened at like 1 o'clock in the morning, Eastern time, 2 o'clock, something like that. It was really a god awful hour. And it was also the first time, or the second time, they had a camera that was supposed to be a little bit better than the first camera they had, which was just an old black and white, awful picture. And we had hired a guy named Bill Baird, who was one of the greatest puppeteers at the time, who they built a moonscape on the floor that was probably 40 feet square. And he built puppets that were exactly like the spacesuits of the astronauts. Several different puppets, actually, little ones and big ones, which they would use for different shots. And sure enough, not only was it a lousy camera, but there was an accident with the camera right at the very beginning. They hadn't been on the moon more than 20 minutes and got the camera out, and it accidentally pointed it to the sun, and it just blew it away. I mean, it burnt everything out in the camera just instantly, almost. At one point, they were trying to fix it. One of my favorite lines from the moon, they were trying to fix it. Al Bain was trying to fix it. And all of a sudden, a picture came back for just a flash, and then it went away. And they said, wait a minute, it's fixed. And what'd you do? And he said, I hit it with my hammer. So, you know, it just... And that was it. I mean, it didn't fix it. It just it never worked. So, but we had those puppets that really looked kind of neat. In fact, it looked so real. We spent a lot of time putting little, what we call lower thirds, across the bottom of the screen that said simulation. You know, this is not the real thing because it looked too good.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with retired NBC television journalist Jim Hartz. Stay with us. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Let's get back now to our conversation with NBC TV news reporter and anchor Jim Hartz. Jim covered some of the biggest stories of the 1960s and 70s and was widely respected then and now for his knowledge and coverage of the U.S. space program during the Apollo program. When we look back at that time and the Apollo era and the moon landing, it's, 50 years on now. There's been, the famous book, The Right Stuff by Tom Wolfe, compared the space program, the early space program to, because of the setting of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, that it was kind of like surrogate warfare in the heavens, that you had, you sent out your knights against each other. And I'm wondering, I watched clips of you doing the 20th anniversary of Apollo 11 from Houston back in 1989. And you gave a very eloquent speech about the meaning of the Apollo program to you. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the meaning of the space program, especially the moon landing and the Apollo program 50 years on, as you look back on it, after being involved in it so intimately?
It's very hard for me now at this stage in my life and career to separate myself from it, from what it may mean to the rest of the world and what it may mean to history. So it's kind of personal. It's the greatest story that I ever covered, personally. It was one time where we were totally supported by our agency, NBC in this case. And I mean, to tell you, we'd go down to Houston, and if you came back to New York after one of those briefings or a space flight, you didn't have an expense account entertaining the astronauts and the other engineers and so on at NASA and getting stories out of them, you hadn't done your job as well as, being on the air. So, I mean, it was that sort of thing. We had almost limitless expense accounts and the support of the agency. So it was really something to do, and it went on for several years. Don't get to do that very often. There are very few stories that are in that league now, elections and conventions and things like that. That only happens for a few days, a year, and every 4 years. This went on for, the Apollo itself was went from 69 to 72, and then not too long after that was Apollo Soyuz, and before that had been Gemini, before that had been Mercury. So these things, was a long time for lots of people who worked on them and really got to know the details of it. For the average person, I'm not sure. But I think, trying to look at a larger picture, that it really is going to be something we'll look back on and have it in the same league with Columbus, probably, or the other explorers of the time, moving out, not really knowing pretty much there's something over there on the other side of the earth, but not knowing what exactly. Columbus thought he was going to Japan. He had totally misread the size of the earth. So he got it all wrong, but nevertheless, he did it four times. He came over four times. and spent all that time in the Caribbean, basically. And I'll tell you what I think maybe probably is the most important thing. We had a briefing down there one time with a bunch of scientists, and bless their hearts. The question was, why go to the moon? And one of them said this. He said, you know, when we first began to look at small things, the first element that we discovered was hydrogen, simplest element there is. And we thought we knew everything about hydrogen there was to know until we discovered helium, which was the next element up the ladder of elements. And then we found out that once we knew something about helium, we learned a lot more about hydrogen and so on and so forth. They looked at going to the moon, the scientists now, going to the moon is the same thing. We thought we knew a lot about the Earth until we got to the moon, and now we're learning more about the Earth since we went to the moon. In fact, we think we know pretty much where the moon came from now. Probably came from a collision with the Earth, with another body, maybe the size of Mars, that ripped out a section of the upper section of the Earth and blew it into orbit that eventually coalesced as the moon. Because the moon seems to be made of mostly what is in the upper part of the Earth. There's no diamonds there's up there. There's no gold. There's no silver. There's no platinum. There's nothing worth mining, looks like. A lot of aluminum, but we had a lot of aluminum on the Earth. So that's the reason I think everybody wants to go to Mars, at least a lot of science community, because that's another step up the ladder of understanding planets. Mars looks like there was a lot of water on that planet at one time. There is not now. What happened? So I'm looking in the future, and I'm not going to live to see going to Mars, I don't think. But I think that my grandchildren will, I do have great-grandchildren. I think they will. In fact, they might be on the ship. Who knows? But I think that's really where we're going as a civilization if we don't mess ourselves up too bad.
Well, we're pretty good at that. and another story before I let you go here pretty soon is sure. That I really thought, you know, the comparing to today's era of journalism, which is very much, you know, kind of what I call gotcha journalism to then, is you told a really interesting story about one of the NASA public affairs officers telling your group of reporters about a camera, and I believe it was on Apollo 15. Could you briefly relay that story? Because I found that to be quite telling.
Sure. I was in a briefing. There's probably about a dozen of us, I guess, and mostly just guys from the networks and the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times, and Chicago papers, It wasn't a PR guy, it was an engineer telling us about this new camera they were flying on Apollo 15. While the two astronauts were down on the moon, the third guy who was on the spacecraft was going to take great pictures with this new camera that was mounted back in the service module. And he was starting to give various specs on it, and somebody asked him what the resolution was, and I can't remember exactly, but it was something like, it was going to be in a 60-mile orbit. All of them were kind of 6-mile parking orbits, and they could see things that were like a meter in diameter, like a bushel basket. So we're all taking this down. And a few minutes later, another guy came in and whispered in this guy's ear something, and the briefer came back and said, guys, beg you to not to say what information I was giving you on that camera. He said, I was wrong about it. It's a top secret camera, and it's been loaned to NASA or whatever it was. And he said, if you guys print any of that or say that on the air, he said, it'll cost me my job and maybe more, who knows? I mean, those days, you know, it was a Cold War, and they could throw you in a jug for state secrets. And the fact, everybody said, yeah. So nobody wrote a word about it. We never said anything on the air about the camera, it was a camera, takes good pictures. And I'm not sure that would happen today. I think we're in a different era of, it's called gotcha journalism. It's waiting for somebody to make a mistake, and then you really, it's mostly politicians now, but works all over. The relationship between the news people and Apollo people or NASA people was really like that. I mean, they trusted us that we'd tell the story straight and know that occasionally we were going to be exposed to secret matters. And there you are. I mean, think about my career. I got to fly the SR-71 and U-2s, but both of them top secret airplanes. I, at that point, got to report most of what I wanted to do. I think I had to submit one script, and I remember a guy made one change in it. And it had nothing to do with the airplane. It had something to do with something else. But those are the kind of trusts that were built in those days between reporters and sources. Today, I'm not sure that happens a lot. It does some, but not everybody can do it like I think most of us were doing it in those days at NASA.
It seems to me after the Challenger disaster, there's quite a split from the close-knit family of journalists, you know, intertwined with NASA. And then after that, it became much more, I'm not sure adversarial is the word, but detached maybe, hyper-objective, however you want to look at it. But could you comment on, you know, what that was like? You were involved in two of the big disasters. I think you had pretty much left by Challenger, but you were still around reporting and things like that. You were there for the Apollo 1 fire and then Challenger. Could you talk about, you know, those disasters a bit?
Yeah. I actually was the pool reporter on the Apollo 1 fire. I happened to be at the Cape when that happened. And for a day or so, I was the only guy there. It was a test that nobody was around. I was down there for a totally different reason. At that point, NASA was pretty closed-mouthed about what was going on, I think, in part because I don't think they really understood it either. They knew there had been a fire, but Lord of mercy. But the disaster that it was, I don't think was clear until after a while. In Challenger, I think the difference there was it was a huge program that had a disaster in the face of millions of people watching it on TV and down the Cape, watching it in person. And it just couldn't be covered up in any way. And so a lot of the reporters then started looking for, you know, what's the real story here? What happened? And there gets to be, my wife and I have a little private thing between us. There was a lot of pressure on those guys to launch that Challenger. And the weather was too cold to do it. I'm not sure whether they really understood that or not, but there was a lot of stuff called, and you know, when are you going to launch? And when are you going to launch? How come you're not launching that kind of stuff, you know? Well, then as soon as you launch and there's a disaster, the reporters are saying, how come you launched? How come you launched?
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a no-win situation. And so that probably is a big change. And I don't know how that sits with the average person, the reader or the viewer, of whether that's a good deal or not. I don't know. I do support a lot of good investigative reporting because there's a lot of things that our government and others hide from us that they don't want us to know that needs to be known. And it's a fine line between that and maybe the way, I don't know whether it's still done this way or not, but back when I was reporting, aircraft accidents were the most thoroughly examined situation that I think I ever knew. And it was because most of the people who were involved told the truth. This is what we did. This is what the instruments said. This is what was going on in the airplane at the time. And so on and so forth. So it was not easy, but you could do an accurate piecing it back together and hope that you could fix it and it never happened again. I'll tell you what, I'm rewatching right now that great HBO series on Chernobyl, you know, the Soviet reactor that blew up, you know, back in the 80s and scattered radioactivity all over the place. And they tried to cover everything up. And the documentary is, you know, three quarters on, or at least half on politics that was involved at the time and the actual destruction of the plant or of the reactor. And it's a splendid piece of work in terms of a fictional account of a real true story. And that's the difference, I think, in the way we in a free country treat things like government disasters and the way other countries do. I prefer ours, but it's the one something that we need to be very careful about it and not abuse it, because if it's abused too much, the hiding will get even better.
Yeah. Well, Jim Hartz, it's been a joy to talk to you, and I so appreciate you spending some time with us and sharing your incredible memories of covering the space program and other aspects of your career. And it just, you know, it's been so fun. Thank you so much.
Dave, you're most welcome. Thank you. I'm glad to help.
Thanks to our guest, retired NBC News journalist Jim Hartz. And a special thanks to our mutual friend, NASA flight director and former head of the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Jerry Griffin, for hooking Jim and I up. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We are distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.